Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I have an amazing episode for you today with the great Alan Aragon. Absolutely incredible nutrition researcher, scientist, nutritionist. This guy is, he's just amazing. If you don't know who he is, you're about to find out. We talk about everything you need to know about protein, how much protein you should be having based on your goals and where you're at. We talk about fiber, how much fiber you should be having, the benefits of fiber, the negatives of fiber. We talk about the carnivore diet. We talk about carbohydrates. We just talk about so much. And we also talk about factors in your life outside of nutrition that massively impact your health and longevity. This episode, it could change your life. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Thank God Alan Aragon came on. He's amazing, and he's taught me a tremendous amount throughout my career. So with all that being said, I'm going to stop talking and let you listen to the episode. All right, we are live. I'm with the great Alan Aragon. Man, it's number one, this is a long time coming. Number two, even though you and I have been friends for years, I still fanboy every time I talk with you. I just think you're one of the most amazing people. I've learned so much from you. For anyone who doesn't know who you are, would you mind just introducing yourself, who you are, where you're from, what do you do, all that stuff?
Sure, man. Sure. Well, before I do that, I want to thank you so much for inviting me on. The admiration is mutual. It's been awesome to see you just rise up in the ranks over the last, gosh, how long have we known each other? Is it like since over 10 years now?
Yeah, I think 11 years now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, man, it's been really great to see the world finally discover the greatness of Jordan Syatt. So I mean that it's really awesome to see. And also, congratulations on your new baby.
Thank you, man.
Phenomenal cuteness is how I described it. It's like just like debilitating, just soul-crushing cuteness is what
I think that's the best way I've heard it described. It is absolutely soul-crushing. Like it like breaks my heart how fucking adorable. It's unbelievable. Yeah, so thank
you. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I love it, man. I love it. So who I am? I am one of the handful of guys who ushered in the evidence-based movement in the fitness industry. And when I say evidence-based, I mean that back maybe 20-ish years ago, a scientific basis was not the standard operating procedure in fitness and nutrition. It was more like, okay, who looks the best? Who's the most shredded over here? Who's got the most awesome physique? Yeah, let's listen to him. Is there a doctor in the house? Let's just take this doctor's words on faith. And so the evidence-based movement was more about cross-checking what we observe in the field with what we see in objective research conditions, because no single one of those avenues is going to cover everything. We need both of them to fill in the knowledge gaps. And there's so many gray areas in our knowledge. We do know a lot of the important stuff, but there's that small margin of stuff that we always argue about. And then there, of course, there's a lot of gray area throughout. So the evidence-based movement in the fitness industry was, for lack of a different way of putting it, it was brought forth by me and maybe just a handful, a couple few other guys. And then it just kind of snowballed from there. And the generations of students and practitioners who learned from us are helping many, many people. So there was a really, really cool trickle down effect that I was able to witness over the decades. So yeah, that's kind of who I am and what my role is currently. As of the past 10 years or so, I've been doing the research studies and the papers that form the foundation of the practice guidelines for practitioners in fitness, whether they be nutrition coaches, dietitians, trainers. We literally do the science that those guidelines are built on. So I'm pretty happy about that. And so yeah, it's always hard to kind of concisely describe who I am and what I do, Jordan. So there you go.
Well, I'm going to give a little background for anyone who doesn't know, and maybe just explain it in a little bit more of a layman's way. So I'll start by saying you were one of the first few people I found online when I was a teenager that introduced me to science-based, evidence-based nutrition specifically, and also then led to strength training as well. But when I discovered you online, it was Lyle McDonald, and Martin Birkin were the three people who really were bringing evidence-based, science-based nutrition to the forefront. And one of the things that drew me to you from a very young age, I don't think that you understand the full impact you've had on me, but one of the things that immediately drew me to you was how, you know, you had like, are you technically a nutritionist? Is that like a PhD? Like what's the actual credential?
That's another tough question to answer, dude. I've settled on calling myself a researcher and educator.
Okay.
Because I guess you can call me a nutritionist. My degrees are in nutrition.
Yeah.
So I do have an undergrad and a master's degree, and both of them are in nutrition. But for some odd reason, you know, when I'm not seeing clients full time, I hesitate to call myself a nutritionist. You know, I'm more of a researcher and an educator. I guess I used to be
okay.
A nutritionist. Yeah.
So one of the things that really stood out to me is I vividly remember seeing you in the bodybuilding.com forums when forums were huge. And I sort of miss those days now, but I remember you openly admitting that you were wrong about meal frequency. And to me, I was a teenager at this time. I was probably 17 or 18, maybe 16 or 17. And as a young teenager, I don't think I had ever admitted I was wrong in my life at that point in time. I don't think I had ever been like, no, like I was wrong. You know, I was stuck in a very like, I'm right, you're wrong teenage boy mentality. And to see you, someone who like had a trusted, loyal following, who you had built your career around the knowledge and trust that you'd built with people, it was like I got the wind knocked out of me. I was like, I thought that was one of the most badass things I had ever seen. And that shift, it was like a tsunami that just was a tidal wave that just took over my entire life, being able to admit when I was wrong. And seeing a professional, as someone at your level, the highest level of science and research and professionalism, to say, hey, by the way, like I was wrong about meal frequency, like this isn't accurate. Now new research has, and more up-to-date research has shown that meal frequency is not as important as we once thought, and da da da. Like I was like, that is, I'm rambling, but wow, that completely fucking blew me away. And you had me hook, line, and sinker ever since then. And you taught me a lot, not just about nutrition and about science and about research, but also about what it means to have your overall integrity and understanding. If you're always searching for the truth, then you're going to have to admit you were wrong at certain times. And so for me, like that was a huge moment when I was becoming a professional in this industry and learning a lot. You have a research review called the Alan Aragon Research Review, which, by the way, I want everyone to know, Alan, I invited Alan on this. I begged Alan to come on. Like this is not a promotion for you. This is just the truth. I've been subscribed to your research review since, I believe it was 2012. You can go back in your system and figure it out. But since 2012, been subscribed, I will never unsubscribe. I originally subscribed because, number one, I wanted to learn the science of everything, that like the truth of the science and how everything works. But equally important for me at the time is I wanted to learn how to read research. I found myself going on PubMed trying to read research and this was what my degree was in, and they taught us the basics of it. But subscribing to your research review and seeing how you broke down studies and seeing how like the critiques of the studies, what was good, what was bad, what about the design was helpful, what wasn't helpful, watching you do that over and over and over again taught me more about learning and understanding research than any course that I paid thousands of dollars for in university. You are one of the leading researchers in the health and science world. So for people, for what that means is, when people reference PubMed studies and scientific research papers, Alan is the guy that's doing the study. Alan is the guy whose his name is on the study. He's the one who's coming up with the study design, planning the study out. Like, it's you're the guy. It's and I think a lot of people they sort of reference studies without thinking that they're understanding there are humans behind the studies. Right, it's sort of like on social media, someone will see someone with a big audience and they'll leave a nasty comment. They don't understand it's a real human behind the screen. I think the same thing when they see studies, they just, and this is one of the issues with studies, right? I'm sure you could go for days on this, is people just, you can always find a study supporting whatever belief you want. It's always there. And I remember, I think the first time ever, I forget the guy's name, but you would remember this guy because he was big back in like the Facebook days when I was like, fuck Facebook, I want to be off Facebook. But he made this whole post about, I think his name was Jahed. He was awesome, really like Jahed. I don't know if you remember him, but he said something to the effect of like, yeah, you know, researchers can lie too. And just like any humans, like researchers can lie too. Researchers can cherry pick data. Like, so that was one of the reasons I always trusted you, is because I found someone who would be fully honest about what's coming up in the research, what's coming up in the literature, without any ego tied to what your previous opinion was. It was just like, I just want to know the truth. And so thank you for that and for everything you've contributed to the industry. You know, you and I published a book on the same day. My book is called Eat It. Your book is called Flexible Dieting. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So I want to make it very clear, if it weren't for you, that book would not have been possible, because so much of what I learned so much of what I put in that book initially came from what I learned from you. So I want everyone to just be aware of, like, so much of the information that we now see all over social media was really truly driven by you. And then also I think Lyle and Martin have to be mentioned as well, but like you're one of the few pioneers of people who really brought it to the mainstream.
Thank you so much for that acknowledgement. Really, it's like, you don't plan to have this kind of influence on the industry. You just go, I want to be an awesome personal trainer. that was my original goal. And that was 30 years ago. And so, well, 31 years ago, come January. And so here we are. I went from saying, I want to be the best personal trainer possible. And now I'm saying, gosh, I'm now at 22 peer-reviewed publications, most of which have shaped the practice guidelines of the fitness industry professionals. So it's really amazing how different things can end up versus what your original goals were. So I'm always fascinated by that, you know? It's interesting that you bring up Lyle McDonald, because Lyle he doesn't get enough credit for pushing the evidence-based angle. First of all, he's kind of stuck in a little corner of the internet, and he doesn't necessarily have mass appeal or mass channels or the bedside manner that would capture the masses. But he definitely deserves credit. And Martin Birkin was one of Lyle's students on the Monkey Island forums. And so it's interesting, you know, the research review was motivated in significant part by a moment I had with Lyle on his forums, which are non-existent anymore. But he had a message board called Monkey Island. And he went through my book, my very first self-published book in 2007 called Girth Control. And he found a claim that I made, which was false per the research, but it was something I was taught by my personal training certifications at the time, which were not necessarily all science-based. And it was the claim that a pound of muscle burned, I forgot the specific figure, I claimed something like 20 to 30 calories per pound. And then Lyle is like, look at this mistake. He made a whole post about it, you know? And he's like, oh, he just went off. He went off on me in front of the, you know, the thousands in his group. And I was like, oh, well, damn. Okay. And he, you know, he provided the reference showing that it was incorrect. And it's more like, it's a little bit closer to like 6 to 10 calories per pound that a pound of muscle burns at rest. And I was like, oh, well, I'll be damned. No, this is this is what I was taught across like two personal training certifications. This is what they taught us, but apparently that's wrong. And so ever since that moment, I committed myself to being better informed about just some of the basic facts of physiology, and that developed into me wanting to be much more informed about the current state of the science on research. So I actually do have Lyle to credit for motivating me to be much more of a stickler and much more OCD about the scientific basis of the things that I believe to be true. And so yeah, in an interesting and indirect way, Lyle had quite the influence on me and my approach to perceiving the things I think I know.
I had no idea. Wow, that's a great story. You know, it's funny. Remember when I was 18, no, I think I was 19. I was 19. I emailed Lyle and I was just like, you know, I love your work. Thank you so much. I asked him if I could intern for him. If I could, hey, like, can I just come? I just want to learn from you. And he was super nice. He just said, hey, listen, like, that'd be great, but there's literally nothing that I could have you do. Like, you would just be sitting around all day. And I was like, okay, I understand. But like, yeah, I've always had a lot of admiration for him. And I think you put it well. He definitely doesn't have the bedside manner for the masses. But I mean, yeah. I don't think you, Lyle, or Martin get enough credit for all of the positive that you did for the industry. And even something as simple as, you know, calorie deficit, right? Which, like, it's like, I can't open Instagram without seeing people saying that anymore. It's like, that would not be as mainstream as it is now were it not for the three of you at all. I just want everyone to know that I think the three of you, and specifically since you're on right now, you were the pioneers behind that. And I appreciate it. And I want everyone to know that. So
thank you.
Moving on. There's so many things we can talk about here. There's so much that we can discuss. I would like to talk to you first, I think, about protein. There's a lot of confusion around protein, and specifically how much protein people need. Yes, we could talk about why, but I would love to talk about how much they need, issues we have with people undereating it, and also potential issues we see with people overeating it. I'd just love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. All right. So the protein topic is really controversial for at least a couple of big reasons. Number one, people fail to specify the population and the goal that we're talking about. You know, there's no universal optimal protein need. We've got to ask, who's the population? Who are we talking about? What's the goal? And, you know, what's at stake? Mm-hmm. So when we ask those questions, then we can begin to narrow it down, like who needs how much protein. So if we start from one end of the continuum, like just the regular general population person wanting to be generally healthy, wanting to have an average amount of physical fitness and a decent chance of living to an average age, let's say. Seriously, that range, that population does just fine on about 50 to 100% more than the RDA. So with the RDA being 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, then we're talking 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight is the appropriate range for the general population without any spectacular fitness goals.
And what does that break down to per pound base for those who are using pounds?
Yeah, in freedom units, that comes down to about 0.5, 0.6 on the low end to 0.7, about, I'm going to say 0.5 to 0.7 grams per pound.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the general pop. Okay. Gen pop. Okay. So with that said, and with that out of the way, we have to move on to a little bit different population, a population who wants to either optimize or maximize their health and fitness levels. And this is going to involve wanting to perform well exercise-wise and wanting to have a body composition that maximizes their chances of preventing chronic disease. Okay, so we're looking at achieving normal to lean body comp. Okay, so this population is not going to optimize these goals on 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. We're looking, edging a little bit more towards 1.6.
Okay.
Or, you know, in freedom units, 0.7 grams. I literally saw that yesterday. Like somebody like said, he just like named off an amount of food in grams. Like I eat 230 grams of strawberries. Somebody's like, damn it, what is that in freedom units? Oh, okay. Well, it's about a cup. Since say just a cup. So yeah. So with the goal in mind of, whenever I say optimize, it's kind of a loaded, it's a loaded term, but let's say optimizing body composition and performance.
Well, we're not being politically correct here. Okay. Optimizing is reducing body fat and building muscle, right? Like getting as lean as you can. Like, it's optimize, I'd say, is the right word.
Cool. Cool. That is the territory of 1.6 grams per kilogram or 0.7 grams per pound of body weight. And the way to get around the problem of over prescribing protein in obese individuals, then you would say 0.7 grams per pound of target or in quotes ideal body weight. Sure, like some people prescribe protein based on units of lean body mass, but then you have to go through the assumptions and the hoops of thinking you can accurately estimate body composition.
Right,
and
right.
Calculate lean mass from that. And that's a whole can of worms with its own set of assumptions. And so what's simpler and just as valid and effective is just basing protein on your target body weight or ideal body weight. And so kind of the magic amount where performance and health and the mitigating of excess body weight happens, where that all kind of comes together, is right around 1.6 grams per kilogram or 0.7 grams per pound of target body weight. Okay, so that's like category two. Okay, so category one would be like the general population. No real pressing goals, no real athletic goals, no real body comp goals, general pop 1.2 to 1.6. Okay. So with this second tier, then we've got 1.6 kind of covering it all. That's like the do it all dose of protein. And there's a third category that I can't leave out because, I work with these folks. I know these folks and, you know, in the back of my mind, I live vicariously through these folks. So we're talking about the guys pushing the envelope for physique and athleticism, and they're often sustaining hypocaloric conditions while they're, maximizing their training output. And so for competitive athletes, I would see the range of 1.6 to 2.2 or 0.7 to a full gram per pound of target body weight being this third kind of level of protein intake that doesn't necessarily apply to everybody, just people trying to push the envelope. Because with people in a dieting phase, protein, when you highball protein, the benefits far outweigh the downsides. There's almost no downsides to highballing protein, aside from the fact that it's expensive. And that's about it. It's expensive. the concerns about ill effects on kidney and bone, those are just not founded. Especially the bone one, that has very, very little support. At least with the kidney concern, you can say, oh, well, my cousin Joe has chronic kidney disease. You're telling me he needs to eat a gram. No, in the literature, it is recommended to kind of lowball your protein at like your RDA levels all the way up to 1.2, some say 1.5 grams per kilo, at max. But this is for people with chronic kidney disease. But what we've seen time and time again in the literature is that high protein intakes don't have negative effects on people with healthy kidneys. They don't even start pushing the needle towards ill kidney health, even with super high amounts. And so yeah, that's the complicated answer to the protein question, where you have these ranges of 1.2 to 1.6 for the first tier, 1.6. Like for most people who want to kind of have a catch-all. And then you've got this 1.6 to 2.2 range for people who are, and you know, there's even published data where even if you go as high as 2.4 towards 3 grams per kilogram, observationally that works for like people dieting for a freaking bodybuilding contest or a physique contest. Or people who are involved in just extreme sports that have these really high demands and sustained hypocaloric conditions in elite, like lean trainees, that you can justify going above 2.2 and into like towards 3 realm. But that's a really, really fringe group. I think that for the majority of the population, if you can just say, you know what, whatever my target body weight is, if I multiply that by, you know, in pounds, my target body weight in pounds, if I multiply that by 0.7, I'm pretty much covering all the bases as far as optimizing my protein intake for the day. Mm. And it's really interesting, Jordan. Like, I've heard some people go, holy crap, that's a lot of protein, you know, because they're used to basically skipping breakfast. And then finally realizing that, oh my gosh, I have to have 50 grams of protein at lunch and then another 70 at dinner to hit this amount. It's like, all right, well, you know, you pick your battles here. You know, what do you want out of your goals? You just have to know that it is what it is and you make it happen. How are you going to make it happen? And thankfully there's things like protein powder that make this stuff just an absolute breeze. I was looking at, protein fluff recipes.
Oh yeah, I remember last night. Yeah.
I've never made it before. I've never had the nerve to make it, but my wife has this really epic like mixing apparatus type of thing.
Yeah. The KitchenAid thing?
Yeah. I think so. I don't know, man, you know. that's like anything that exists out of like a standard man cave. I don't really know what it's called, you know?
Yeah. Yep. I only know, I remember my mom got my wife a KitchenAid mixer, must've been about a year ago now. And I remember when my wife opened the gift, she literally gasped. She was like, oh, I've always wanted one of these. And so, and I'm pretty sure that's the mixer that you use to make the protein fluff.
Yeah. It's a thing that comes up and it's got this epic, like, I'm pretty ignorant at the kitchen appliance thing, but yeah, I want to try it. I want to, because I can just imagine myself getting obsessed with it and making these wonderful protein powder creations. Cause I feel like I've mastered the shake thing. Two of my meals in the day are protein shakes, and I look so forward to having them. And I can't imagine just the inconvenience of not having protein powder. I totally understand how nobody wants to eat, you know, 6 tons of chicken, boiled chicken breast, and, or, you know, eight troughs of beans to hit their protein. And so protein powder is definitely something that people can take advantage of. I was even asked the question of, okay, what would you say is your go-to food? What's the most important food that a dieter can have? And I'm like, gosh, well, protein powder would be one of them.
Really?
It just takes care of the protein, you know, issue, like instantly and economically and just really conveniently. And, you know, protein powder is often vilified as not a real food, but the fact of the matter is it's an exception in the category of foods that you would call highly processed. And, you know, not in quotes, a real food, because it's highly engineered. But protein powder, I would make an exception for that as far as classifying the foods go, because it's just like the most nutrient dense part of milk. You're just basically separating that out. You're getting basically taking the lactose, the sugar out of milk. And there you have it. You have your whey, or your whey and casein, and everything that comes with it. So
what is your,
it's kind of a miracle.
What's your favorite go-to protein shake that you have on a day-to-day basis? Like, what's the recipe?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what you do is you make a pot of coffee and then you cool it off, put it in the fridge.
Wow. I did not expect it to start this way. This is like, okay.
Yeah, man. So absolutely. And so, in the morning you grab that coffee, or you could just do the lazy way and just make the pot of coffee and just let it sit and cool overnight to room temperature. And my go-to breakfast for most of the year is, okay, it starts off with 1 to 2 frozen bananas, depending on the size of the banana. So I always keep bananas just sort of broken off into like 5-ish pieces each banana, and just keep them in the freezer. And so you add the equivalent of like 1 to 2 bananas. I honestly do 2 bananas, and I add about a cup and a half of ice to that. Then I add about 2 heaping tablespoons of unsweetened cocoa. And then I do 2 scoops of your favorite chocolate protein powder.
Okay.
And I just use straight ahead whey protein powder, and Optimum is the brand that I use most of the time. And then you add about, depending on how thick you want to make the shake, somewhere between 12 to 16 ounces of that cold coffee. Mm. Most people would probably like it at around the 12 ounce mark. And then you just blend the hell out of it. And then you've got just the most delicious damn mocha protein shake like ever. And I'm still having it, even though it's the dead of winter.
Yeah,
I still have that cold ass mocha shake in the morning. So yeah, that's one of the recipes that
I love it.
I love. Yep. And then another recipe that I also really like is, okay, just stock frozen blueberries, and then use ice frozen bananas, and about a, you know, 3/4 of a cup, full cup of blueberries, and then 2 scoops of vanilla protein powder in there. And you can either use water or milk for the liquid component, which is going to be about 12-ish ounces. And then there you have this enormous, lovely and delicious purple shake. And so those are sort of the 2 sides of the coin of awesomeness for protein shakes for me. I have a 3rd variation that I don't know if I should tell it because it's sort of like the secret.
If you have recipe. A secret, you don't have to. You already gave away two. You can keep one for a secret. Maybe release that in an AAR Alan Aragon Research Review edition. I would love to see it there. Get people to sign up for the shake.
I'll withhold it because but dude, those two alone, I've often spent, you know, many days having one of those in the morning and another one either in the afternoon or as like a nightcap. And seriously, like having two of those shakes takes care of almost 100 grams of protein.
Yeah, it's easy.
So everything else is just real easy to get your protein from. So those are the shakes, man.
So I know we could spend hours just on protein. I'm going to shift gears a little bit just because, like, mm-hmm. if anyone wants to learn any more, go to Alan Aragon's Instagram page. We'll put your Instagram in the show notes just so people can go check it out. But go to his Instagram. Definitely sign up for the research review. It's what I've been subscribed to since, like, 2012. I want to talk about fiber. Fiber is something I've been, as you've probably seen, on a big kick on recently. I think it's something that's woefully underemphasized, especially in the – you know what's funny? I think it's pretty well emphasized in the mainstream, but, like, when you get into the fitness industry, when there's a lot of, like, bodybuilding and physique stuff, like, I just don't see people – talking about it very much. I'd love to hear your thoughts on fiber recommendations and also, like, why it's important. And if you don't think it's important, then say that as well. But, like, just give your thoughts on fiber.
Yeah. Fiber is just one of those things in nutritional science that every topic, every nutrient, every food stuff in nutritional science has a body of evidence saying it's bad. And then a body of evidence saying it's good. And so there's different, like, levels of these things. Fiber is one of those things in nutritional science where the win column is stacked super duper high and the loss column is almost non-existent. I mean, for you to get ill effects from fiber, you'd have to eat ungodly amounts of it. But for the most part, you're just getting benefits from it. And so...
what are the benefits? Like, what are the benefits of getting enough fiber?
Sure. At kind of like the fitness level, fiber is one of the factors in the diet that provides satiety. And some might argue that the effect is small or the effect is weak. But when you combine fiber with water and protein, I mean, you kind of have the trifecta of satiety and hunger control there. And of course the ketos would be like, yeah, why don't you just add like 800 calories of butter there? You'll be super satiated. And I'm like, oh yeah, you would, but you'd also have 800 calories of butter.
Pure.
Just pure fat, man. And so, there's the satiety factor. There's a good body of literature on its positive effects on the gut microbiota or the gut microflora, the diversity of the different microorganisms in the gut. And there's also a good body of data on fiber indirectly and directly preventing chronic disease. So improving glycemic control, controlling factors that contribute to the development of atherogenesis and, you know, cardiovascular disease. There's a consistent body of evidence on fiber-containing foods, at least, mitigating the development of those disease states. And so it's really, there's just a convergence of multiple lines of evidence pointing to the health benefits of dietary fiber. And it's really kind of weird when people push back against that. And it's usually the carnivore crowd who just really want to justify their avoidance of plants. They're like, yeah, fiber's not necessary. You know, you don't need fiber to survive. It's like, well, you know, there's a difference between living to an average age versus optimizing that time that you're living and making sure that you're doing what you can to optimize health. And so fiber is just one of those things where if you leave it completely out of the diet, then you're not doing everything you can to maximize your health and minimize your risk for chronic disease. And so as far as dosing goes, there's actually a position stand that was written by the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and they boiled their recommendations down to 14 grams for every 1,000 calories that you consume per day. Mm. So for the average Joe, average Jane, on a 2,000 calorie intake, that's going to be 28 grams of fiber. So sort of the guideline of, let's say, 25 to 40 grams of fiber in a day is kind of right in line with what people should be having. If you kind of average like 30-ish grams of fiber in a day, then you're kind of doing all that we know to maximize health and as far as fiber goes.
Now, do you track your fiber intake personally?
I don't personally track it. And that's because I am fortunately married to a woman who cooks really well. Actually, she cooks amazingly and she loves vegetables. She just happens to love vegetables. So when she prepares vegetables and plant foods, I love it. So I just eat a lot of it. And I'm also one of these guys who's not anti-grain and, anti-plant food. So I get right around the ballpark of fiber that the position stands recommend. And some days I don't quite hit it, but I think that it's okay to, at least make the effort. And if you're kind of getting 80% of what we know to be healthy, you're still hedging your bets in the right direction.
That makes sense. Okay. You mentioned the carnivore crowd and, mm-hmm. There's so much we could possibly say about them. I remember you came to the Inner Circle Retreat, you spoke at the Inner Circle Retreat, you gave one of the best presentations I've ever seen in my life around nutrition.
Thank you.
I remember we went out to dinner, I think it was the first night, you, me, Susan, Kat, maybe, I think that was it the first night, and then Alex Viotta came later. I remember, and I might have heard wrong, but I'd love to just hear your thought. I've literally thought about this since you said it. Mm. I asked something to the effect of, what are your thoughts on what their health will be like long term? Because I don't want anybody to get sick. Online people can be so ruthless and be like, yeah, you're going to die. I don't want someone to get sick and die early because of the diet they chose. Yeah. And I asked what your thoughts on the long-term health of those who follow the carnivore diet might look like if mm-hmm. you had to predict. Mm-hmm. And I think you had said you don't know, but your hypothesis is that for the people who are still remaining physically active and the mm-hmm. people who still have a healthy body composition, you didn't expect there to be deleterious effects on their health. But I don't know if I remember correctly or if that's, but I, what are your thoughts on that? If you are able to give like what your thoughts are for both the people who are still remaining physically active and all that, but also for the people who might be following that type of diet and not, optimizing their health and fitness in other ways, like staying physically active, reducing their overall body fat, all that. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, man. Okay. So I have to preface my answer with the concept that humans are an incredibly resilient species. Like, we can withstand the widest variety of physiological insults throughout the course of our lifetimes and still just kind of live these ripe, long lives, just skating along with suboptimal levels of nutrient intake the whole time through. So it's, I don't want to downplay the role of diet in mm-hmm. health, but I think that we tend to put dietary habits up on this pedestal while other lifestyle factors, both physical and psychological, psychosocial, we sort of tend to downplay the role of those things in longevity. Mm. And so, like you mentioned, if somebody stays physically active and they maintain good body composition, throughout their lifetime. Even a carnivore diet won't necessarily take them out. It won't necessarily lead them expeditiously down a path of disease. Is it suboptimal? Yeah, for sure. It's suboptimal. But
in what ways is it suboptimal? I'm interested to hear that.
Yeah. The carnivore diet is suboptimal micronutritionally. The main, as far as essential micronutrition goes, the big concern would be vitamin C adequacy.
Is that why we see some of their gums bleeding and stuff? Is that why we see some of that?
Yeah, we do see some of that. And the carnivore community, like they really downplay the instances that people in the communities report that and complain about it. But there's always carnivore solutions for that, right? They'll just tell you to just eat a ton of raw liver or something. Just take care of that problem. There is the issue with vitamin C, and that would be the big one. And then there are other things that are not necessarily essential micronutrition related, but are still components, dietary components that can prevent chronic disease kind of over time. So a lack of antioxidant polyphenols that you see in plant foods that are consistently associated with lowering of chronic disease risk, and a lack of fiber comes into play as well. And just a lack of the spectrum of nutrition, both known and unknown, that are present in fruits and vegetables. And these are only things that can be studied really at the population level, and the association with dietary intake and disease, you can only really just look at that observationally, because you can't really run a randomized controlled trial for 20 years and have one group avoid plants and the other group eat like a plant-loaded diet and take a look at what disease manifests in one or both of the groups. So there's just, it's a gamble. The carnivore diet is a gamble as far as heart disease goes, as far as cardiovascular disease goes, because even in the only study published to date looking at the carnivore diet observationally, and the title of the study is called Behavioral Characteristics and Self-Reported Health Status Among 2,029 Adults Consuming a Carnivore Diet. That's the name of the observational study. And it was a convenience sample taken from the online carnivore community.
So you already have to take into consideration that these are people who are probably going to say, I love the carnivore diet, it's amazing. Like, that's magic. People who are doing it, like, those are the people most likely to actually take the survey. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They reported all positive health outcomes. all their health outcomes were positive. There were a couple of red flags. LDL went up, then again, there's a lot of lipid deniers in the carnivore community. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of the people in the carnivore community are better off health-wise than they were on the standard American diet, or the SAD diet, which just has too much of everything. So the carnivore diet, what it does for these folks, it at least facilitates a lower total caloric intake through the course of the day or the course of the week. And that is a huge problem with folks that they had before getting on the carnivore diet. And so, but then they are presented with these new problems of elevated LDL and an elevated coronary artery calcium score. So that is a concern. There was a subset of the subjects in the study that showed a significant increase in their CAC scores.
Oh, wow.
As a result of being on the carnivore diet. And I think that there are ways that you can get on the carnivore diet and optimize it for health. And I say that very carefully, because You can't optimize health by cutting out all plant foods. As far as the evidence goes today, as we know it, that's a no. However, a lot of the carnivore community are so drawn, they're just, I don't know, it's a personality type, it's a state of mind, it's just their perceptual construct is just geared towards, if it's more extreme, it's better. So not only am I gonna cut out plant foods, I'm gonna severely limit the range of animal foods I eat, and I'm just gonna eat cow flesh. I'm just gonna eat fatty cow flesh. That's gonna be my diet, ribeye, that's it. That kind of goes against everything we know as far as diet and disease goes. Mm. So if you wanted to optimize your carnivore diet, have a range of stuff. Eat your ribeyes, great, fine. But also have chicken, have fatty fish, have eggs. cover the range. Get a spectrum of nutrition in there. With the people who are experiencing the most drastic adverse effects from the carnivore diet, they're probably avoiding fish because it's not manly enough to eat fish compared to eating a ribeye.
Got it.
Bro, come on now.
So it's one of those things where we can't predict, we don't know, but it's definitely not optimal, to say the least.
Yeah, the signs are there, man. The signs are there. But the reason why it so powerfully captures people is because anytime you're confined to just eating a very narrow set of foods and you're in a state of obesity, you're going to end up eating 500 to 1,000 calories less per day. And that's going to manifest in some really positive outcomes.
Mm.
It might not be optimal way to do it, but people get really captured by just this massive weight loss. And along with weight loss comes these positive clinical consequences as
right.
well. They feel a lot better. Obviously, there, a bunch of clinical indexes are improved, glucose control, the whole thing. But now they're just stuck with eating chunks of flesh.
That's it.
That's all you get.
Plants are killing them with these like plant toxins and protective mechanisms, just nonsense out of nowhere.
It is total nonsense, man. Like the whole idea that, plants don't want you to eat them. You know, they've got all of these mechanisms in place to poison you and all that stuff. Okay, that sounds good on paper. Then if it were true, why are we not seeing populations who consistently eat an abundance of plant foods just dying off quicker
right.
than populations who minimize the plant foods? Why are we not seeing that? Why are we seeing in controlled interventions the intermediate health markers improve consistently with a high plant food intake? You know, why are we not seeing that either? Why mortality? Why are we just not seeing like higher mortality amongst people with an abundance of plant food intake? So it's one thing to name, this sort of hypothetical mechanism that plants are going to come get you, like the Venus flytraps are going to like choke you out if you try to eat them and stuff. But it just doesn't pan out when you look at the human health outcomes.
Yeah. Not to mention, it's like animals don't want us to eat them either. Like no one,
they'll kill you. They'll rip you apart.
Mechanisms too, but odds are you're paying for somebody else to kill them for you. It's like, So
that's a good point.
There's one thing I want to talk to you about now before we finish. And I know we could go on all day, but I know you're super busy, and honestly, I just miss my daughter when I'm not there. But this is one thing I want to talk about. I think it's super overlooked, and you mentioned it earlier. You mentioned the effects of longevity outside of nutrition. You mentioned social, psychosocial. You mentioned these other things that can be super important in terms of health and longevity. Could you talk about some of those things that like are outside of nutrition? Like, what are things that are affecting people's health and longevity outside of nutrition that people need to pay more attention to?
Yeah, the kind of the concrete ones. And I'll talk about the hard to put a finger on ones. The concrete ones would be staying physically active and doing what you can to maintain a, in quotes, favorable body composition. So staying physically active can come in a different number of forms. You don't have to be like you're training to be an endurance athlete all the time. There is a body of literature showing that elite endurance athletes just on average live X amount of years longer than power lifters. Okay. And so people have taken that literature and said, see, you guys can't just lift, got to do cardio too. But, you know, once you control for body composition, for body fat levels specifically, then, you know, strength training versus endurance training sort of washes out. Because those factors are not controlled for. Diet quality is never controlled for in these observational studies showing that elite endurance athletes live long. Elite endurance athletes, not only do they maintain this high degree of leanness, but they're already kind of like health nut hippies to begin with. And so that's reflected in their food selection. And they typically are consuming this healthy dietary pattern, which to the best of our knowledge today resembles sort of a Mediterranean diet. That includes, you know, seafoods and a lot of plant foods as well, and a certain
whole
spectrum
grains and
of the food groups. Right, legumes, all that stuff. And so, that's the issue with drawing the conclusion that okay, you can't just lift. Well, yeah, you can just lift if you lift a decent amount. I mean, if somebody's just doing like that 10-minute miracle workout twice a week. Okay, well, then you can't just lift, right? You need to bring your activity level up. But the people, I kind of take issue with people citing the research showing longer lifespans of endurance folks. I kind of take issue with that because I'm a guy who would, I train my ass off lifting wise 4 to 5 days a week. And so there's not a whole lot of room left in the schedule to add endurance work, et cetera. So physical activity, you got to personalize that. Most people, as far as physical activity goes, they'll benefit from walking. Walking is kind of a lost art of just using the body to get from one place to another. It's kind of a lost art. So maintaining good body composition, maintaining a certain baseline of physical activity and training, actually. Those are the two non-dietary things that are kind of undervalued.
Mm.
And then the non-concrete stuff, the stuff that's hard to measure, the stuff that's hard to test for, is maintaining good and meaningful interpersonal relationships. So maintaining good relationships between you and your friends and your family and your business associates, just your social circle. So interpersonal relationships. And then the other component is maintaining a good
personal
relationship. yes. So if you maintain a good relationship with yourself, and you maintain a good relationship with others, then you're doing a whole lot to further the chances that you'll live a healthy, long life. There's kind of another layer there that can help, and this is obviously very hard to study. But if you can maintain a good spiritual relationship with the in quotes universe, or what I like to call God, very controversial, then that's the highest level that you can go as far as the non-physical, hard to measure stuff that increases longevity. Because everybody hits hard times and low points in their lives. And if all you have to rely on during your lowest points is your damn self or your friend Joe or your family members who are busy watching Netflix in Ohio somewhere, you can be quite screwed, my friend. So, but that gets a little way out there. But yeah, maintaining good body comp, maintaining physical activity. Because really, immobility and physical inactivity is the beginning of the end for people as they hit middle age and beyond. And the dietary solution is not cut out carbs. As much as everybody wants it to be, it's so simple, right? All you got to do is avoid carbs. I would rather say the simple solution is find the diet that you can stick to. The diet that allows you to not overeat, whatever the hell it is, whether it's low carb, low fat, high carb, high fat, whatever it is, if it's the one that you personally can stick to, find that one, find out what that is. And, do what you can to strengthen your inter and intra personal relationships and keep that physical activity up. And I think that's the recipe.
Good. I love that. And I will say, just from my own personal experience and from all the people I've coached, one of the things I've seen help with building it inter and intrapersonal relationships is going to the gym. You know, and we can see, you know, having a community, it's sort of along the same lines of the research around, you know, spirituality, religion, having a higher purpose. I think a lot of people overlook the community that you can gain just from going to a great gym and meeting friends there, improving you're working and improving on yourself. And you can also ideally meet people with similar goals and similar aspirations who are hardworking, want to better themselves. And there's just, we hear it all the time, you know, who you surround yourself with is you're the average of that. But, I think the most common, or one of the more common, whether we call it a deflection or excuse or whatever it is, people will say is, well, what if I like struggle to do that? How am I supposed to, what if I struggle to get myself out there? Which is a valid concern and worry, but it's one of those things you have two options. You either push yourself out there, you go to the gym, maybe you say hello to someone, give them a smile, you compliment someone on their form and you start connecting with them, or you just don't and you stay where you are and you just let life go. That's basically, you always have two options, either do it or you don't. It's going to be hard no matter what. But I think, and I know you and I are on the same page with this, having a community or a strong community around you is just like, it's one of the greatest blessings in the world. And I think you have to seek it out. You have to seek it out and find people that are on the same wavelength as you, going for similar things and have similar values, morals, ethics, and priorities is just makes sense. It just makes sense that you're going to have a better chance of being here longer and a higher quality of life. So Alan Aragon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I asked Alan to come on. He had no idea what I was going to do, but sign up for his research review if you really, really, really want to learn the science, the evidence-based nutrition. There's a lot of training stuff as well. But, it's funny. A lot of people ask how I came up with the idea for the Inner Circle. And I don't think most people realize I got the idea for the Inner Circle from the research review. It comes out once a month and you know, it gives you like all of the latest research with your commentary on it. And I was like, I want to do that, but for not coaches, I want to do that for everyday people who just want health and fitness, so I started, here's your program for the month. Here's your nutrition guidelines. Here's your video courses, all that. But I got the whole idea of the Inner Circle from looking at what you did with the research review. And I just, you've impacted my life and my life, and as a result, hundreds of thousands of other lives, and I will forever be indebted to you, and I appreciate you immensely. So thank you for coming on, Alan.
Dude, let me just say real quick that the Inner Circle community that I was able to experience during the retreat, some of the coolest, just most down-to-earth, good-hearted people I've ever encountered. And I mean, I'd love to name off all of them, but I would miss some folks. But you truly have a magically awesome community going. And it makes me so happy to see it. And it restores my faith in humanity to see it exist and grow. So keep up the great work. And, kudos to all your listeners as well.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. I'm going to stop recording now, and then we'll be good to go. That wraps it up for this episode of the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed it, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes or Spotify. They really do help a lot. And if you'd like to join the Inner Circle, you can do that at the link in the show notes or www.sfinnercircle.com. Have a wonderful day, and I'll talk to you soon.